ready for questions. Fire at will. Questions? Somebody had questions about the fire exam. Yeah. What you probably observed was that I didn't go through them as systematically.
Yeah. Is that okay?
Let me see if this helps. In the practice exam, you have a fair, not practice, in the mini exam, you have a fairly limited set of items to cover. And you can kind of go through them all. In the midterm, there simply isn't time to do that. You have to be more selective to say, okay, I will talk about res ipsa loquitur because it applies. I won't talk about nuisance because it doesn't apply. When I do talk about negligence per se, I will point out that you know, there would be an excuse to negligence per se, and so I might not go through all of the different elements of negligence per se before reaching that conclusion. Again, as I've said before, let me put it this way, just so you understand my evaluative process. If this were simply a matter of remembering all the rules, and remembering them precisely so that you could word for word describe the three elements of the test for res ipsa loquitur. As you can tell by looking at the condensed outline is, you know, about 5 pages long. Now, most of you are bright enough that in 3 days, you could commit that whole thing to memory. I mean, you could word for word, you know, remember each of those things. If that's what this course were about, if to get an A, you could recite it beginning to end, word for word, I would imagine there would be some people who could do it with just 3 days worth of, you wouldn't have bothered with whatever it is we're into now, closing in on, you know, it'll be approximately 4 weeks by the time the midterm rolls around. It would have been a waste of those 4 weeks if what I really wanted was to see somebody just word for word recite it. That's really not what it's all about. Instead, the question is, understanding that, can I identify those places where the doctrines will do my client some good or pose a risk to my client such that I need to advise my client to look to this doctrine for help or to be ready for this doctrine to work against them. And so, as I've said before, one of the skills, perhaps the most important skill, rather than simply knowing the material, is being able to exercise good judgment about this applies, this doesn't. Now, of course, the maddening thing from your perspective, the way in which this appears to be one of those cognitive dissonance experiments, in which, you know, the laboratory animals are placed in a cage and you first set up this thing where one door has food behind it and the other door has a mild electrical shock, and the laboratory animals by trial and error discover where the food is and where the shock is, and you can actually switch that maybe once or twice. But if you set it up, the classic cognitive dissonance experiment, if you set it up so it's a purely random setup and they never know from 1 minute to the next if they touch this thing, if they're going to get food or if they're going to get shocked, they go off into a corner and twitch and starve to death. That's the effect of cognitive dissonance, and you undoubtedly feel you're getting more than your share of it in terms of, you know, he who hesitates is lost, but look before you leap, and you know, talk about these issues, but don't waste your time on that. And you sort of feel like you keep switching the rules on me to say conflicting things. If you only gave me one straight answer, I could do that. And you would have some justification in feeling that way. Much of law school is sort of a gigantic cognitive dissonance experiment. But that's because the practice of law is in many ways a cognitive dissonance experiment. No sooner do you learn how to do this case than you need to do just the opposite in the next case. What works for this client doesn't work for that client. What works for this judge doesn't work for that judge. And part of what you have to do is navigate your way through these sort of conflicting things. My boss tells me, gee, you know, you need to have a life. You need to spend time with your family. Oh, by the way, could you have the summary judgment motion done by tomorrow? You know, I'm given these conflicting instructions here, and I could do one or the other, but I'm having a terrible time trying to do these two things that are moving in opposite directions. So, again, in terms of figuring out, do I spend my time listing all the elements of a res ipsa claim, or do I summarize it very quickly, superficially, and move on to something else? I'm, in effect, saying, yeah, that's the assignment. Figure that out. Figure out, as you look at the prior exams, and practice using them to see how close am I coming to the standard. Part of it is, yes, I do want to state the rules accurately. I want to be able to apply them correctly when it's called upon, but I also want to see how well I'm doing in making these judgment calls. This is an important issue. This deserves quality time from me, whereas this other thing, I'll give it a quick sentence and move on because it's really not applicable. And then see how well that matches up with and learn from your mistakes where you devoted a whole bunch of time to something that turns out, oh, yeah, I could have done that with a sentence. And in other areas where you gave the sentence and it turns out, gee, there's a lot more there than met the eye. So I guess all I can say is that as you move in that direction, you're moving in the right direction of sort of saying, I can do all this. It's just a question of budgeting my time and figuring out where is it. Of course, the more facile you get at spitting the rules out and applying them, the more you can cover in a particular amount of time. The more you're sitting in the exam room trying to piece things together, let's see, that was, what's that second element? No, that's not quite right. Start with a B. You know, the more you're doing that, the slower you're going to be, the more issues you're going to have to leave off the table because you can't process them quickly. When I give you my sample answers, I'm giving you something that's relatively compact, which is something you know, I get many answers that are at least half again longer than my sample answer. Some people who really type fast or who write fast will give me twice as much as it's in the sample answer. And one of the things I try to show you is you don't have to write all the words. You can do it in a relatively compact way, but of course, I know exactly what I'm looking for. I can pick these off with a rifle shot, and it's going to take you probably a little more space to do it in. The faster you get at being able to process these things, spit out the rules, apply them, and move on, the more you're going to be able to, you know, give me more than I need, but better to give me more than I need than less than I need. Anyway, long answer to the question. But it's the right question to be asking. Mr. Glover.
I have a question about the loss of chance.
Yeah.
Doctrine. The plaintiff is trying to show that the defendant was responsible for this loss of chance.
Yes.
And you said it's like a light switch, it's on or off, it's either on or it's off. The question is, what are they trying to show? They're responsible for this loss of chance, but like in the case where little boy fell,
yeah.
I mean, he was going to die, so what was the loss?
We don't know that.
Well, okay, if you assume...
See, what the... What,
is that what they're trying to show? That?
Well, the case itself is sort of the mental image to get you started thinking about this. In the actual case, there is either an up or down question for the jury. Either the plaintiff shows more probably than not he would have survived and they recover damages, or the plaintiff falls short of that, shows that there was a chance he could have survived, but it wasn't better than even. If it is the jury's finding that he more probably than not would have died, according to the traditional rule, he loses. Correct. Any kind of scenario where, yes, the defendant deprived the plaintiff of a chance to avoid the injury, but you know what? It was more probable than not that the plaintiff was going to suffer this injury anyway, and the worst you can say about the defendant is they deprived the plaintiff of a chance of avoiding it. So that, again, is why the Hardy versus the phone company case probably... this was going to be a fatal heart attack anyway. Okay, so we negligently deprived her of medical care, but the medical care probably wouldn't have done her any good. So the defendant says, I owe nothing. And the plaintiff says, now wait a minute. Negligently you deprived me of a chance of survival, or deprived my wife of a chance of survival. You admit you were negligent. You admit there was a chance she could have made it and you blew it. And now you're saying you owe me nothing. I say you owe me the value of that chance. And the question is, can we go there? Can we convert this on-off light switch into a, you know, dimmer switch where we can adjust the recovery to correspond with what we think is the probabilistic chance that was involved? And again, that triggers the policy question of, well, if you're going to do it in the plaintiff's favor, are you going to start doing it in the defendant's favor? So the defendant gets to shave off from Mrs. Reynolds' recovery whatever chance there was that even with good light she would have fallen anyway? I don't think so. So maybe we should just leave it in this on-off situation where the probabilities are all or nothing. And we don't mess with these sort of variable kinds of deals. The one place where we do think that that's appropriate, or courts think it's appropriate, is in the area of medical malpractice. Again, because you have pretty firm statistical data, and you have this policy concern that it would lead to poor medical care. So the Siamese twins that they just lost in Singapore are, you would say, they didn't have a better than 50% chance of survival. No matter how negligent we were, we owe nothing because they more probably than not would have been injured. If you think you need a loss of a chance remedy to restrain doctors from committing malpractice, then okay, we could do it. Mr. Herbert Holtz?
I'm a little confused about that.
Okay.
That's
part of the difference. In alternative liability, we have to have all the defendants who could have caused the injury in the courtroom. But we don't have to have an agreement. We just have to show that all of them were acting negligently. One of them caused the injury. I can't tell which one. Concert of action by contrast requires a showing of an agreement. We agreed to engage in a drag race or a balloon war or some other kind of tortious activity by agreement. But I don't have to bring in all the defendants. So it was this fraternity party kind of thing. There were about seven or eight people running around doing this balloon war. I can show that these two defendants were part of the group that agreed to do this. It was their bright idea to engage in this. If I can show there was an agreement to engage in this tortious conduct, they are liable, even though I'm missing the other six people. So alternative liability is dealing from a full deck. Concert of action is I've got an agreement. Ms. Reed.
On the Cardoza theory of the zone of danger and the Andrews theory, what the proximate cause issue is decided by the jury?
For Andrews, the proximate cause issue is for the jury. For Cardozo, it's a scope of duty question. And again, we had shades of that this morning when we were talking about what is the, should the state of New York be liable for, Mrs. Johnson's daughter's injury? Do they owe her a duty? So Cardozo sees this as a question about scope of duty, which is a question for the judge. Boundaries of legal rules and liability. Whereas again, Andrews is saying this isn't about principles, it's about practicalities. It's about, the messy details of a particular case. That we throw to a jury and say, you sort it out. How close were these things, give them all these factors to consider and let them decide which injuries were proximately caused by the defendant's negligence as opposed to which ones weren't. So again, it's the question they are asking, the approach that they take to establish which plaintiffs get to recover and which don't. Yes, Ms. Shoemaker.
With enterprise liability, if it's found that the defendant concerted inaction not to adopt the safety policy that they had the ability to adopt, are they held jointly and severally liable, or is each defendant held severally liable?
I would guess that they're all held jointly and severally liable. Again, because we're going to take that issue up later on, I don't want to have you get too far into that part of it, and I wouldn't expect you to discuss that on the exam. The only place where it is kind of relevant is that what we know about market share liability is that it's individual liability. And the only reason for going into that is because it's a lower priority. If I could fit into one, two, or three, I want to go there before I essentially wind up doing market share liability as a last resort. Because with market share liability, I'm only going to pick up the individual checks here, whereas if I can meet one of the other three theories, I'm able to get a full recovery. But the exact details of how they work, I'm hoping I can steer around, because we're not really ready to look at the whole issue until we get to chapter 6. Ms. Reich, I think you had a question about a prior exam.
Yeah, I was just going to have you review this last summer's exam.
What was it about?
It was the case that was in static shield guard wire that knocked down on the other transition line. It was really technical.
Okay.
The second question.
Right. There's a wrongful death case. The guy gets killed by the... Okay. Yeah. Part of the question was, and let me just talk about technical questions generally. I confess, I have thrown at you questions that are quite detailed in terms of, some industrial process or some long, complicated set of facts. I gave a summer exam probably 7 years ago that involved this long, it was an environmental case. It was a pollution case, and the facts were like 10 pages long. You know. Now, let me just sort of say about exams generally. I try to kind of stay in the middle, you know, not like baby bear's porridge, not too hot, not too cold, but just right. But occasionally I get drawn into something that's a little bit different. Like the mini exam was different because there's no strict liability there. In many ways, it's like having a, you know, if you're up playing golf and you have a hole that's 120 yards long, it's, you know, in some ways that's a lot easier than this par 5, 400-yard hole that you have to get to. But each one, you know, since this is all, I don't want to get too Darwinian about this, but to the extent that it's comparative, you know, the old joke about the guys in the tent, and they hear this bear coming, and so one of the guys puts on his shoes, and the other guy looks at him and says, you can't outrun a bear. And he says, I don't have to outrun the bear, I just have to outrun you. To some extent, you know, as you look at the problem on an exam, you may either be delighted to see, oh, this looks easy, but you know, be very afraid, because it's going to be easy for everybody else too. And so, in many ways, an easy exam has the greater danger that you're going to miss something. And whereas if you have that par 5, you know, 450-yard hole with a big dog leg, the advantage of it is that it can sort of, you have, you know, everybody's going to find that hole difficult. You actually have a chance to make up some strokes there if you hit it down the center of the fairway and get to the green in three shots. So, again, if you have a 10-page fact pattern, you say, well, everybody's got this 10-page fact pattern. It's not like, you know, I'm suffering some disadvantage that other people don't have, but the name of the game, or it's about it, some technical field. Actually, the greatest danger, I might add, is if you had spent 5 years working construction. You know, you were on a carpenter or an electrician, and you spent 5 years, you know, building condominiums, and you get a fact pattern that's about, you know, the construction of a, you know, subdivision or something. You think, oh goody, I know all about this. Well, it's very bad news, because you're going to start reading into it, not the legal issues. You're going to say, well, of course, these people were stupid for using a 2x4 when they should have been using a 2x8, and everybody knows that this is an old piece of equipment. You know, you're going to start wanting to do your thing on the facts, or a medical case with the medical background, some other thing. You happen to know the inside of this case, or I gave a question most recently in the spring exam where it happened to be taken from Wyoming, and some of the students in the class were from Wyoming and knew the people involved. You know, that's actually a bad sign. Because you're gonna start reading into it things you happen to know about it, rather than doing the legal analysis, which is, you know, what are the legal issues here? What do I know about them? What can I say about them? By contrast, what are the things that I should be circumspect about and say, I really don't know the answer to this question. So, because if I pick the case out, I don't know much about construction. I don't know much about these industrial processes, about these wires and stuff. What I do know, however, is I know that people who have high voltage lines may be subject to strict liability. I don't know whether they are or not, but I certainly want to raise that issue. I also know something about causation. So as I read the facts of the case, and I follow, they tell me that this happened and then that happened and then that happened, I want to ask the question, well, as I write it down, it's the thing starts over here with a thingamajig and then goes to a whatchamacallit, I don't know what these things are, but I'm told that this happened, and that happened, and this other thing happened. Well, is one of these things a superseding cause of the injury? Is this a cause without which the injury would not have occurred? Do I have a loss of a chance problem? Do I have a multiple redundant cause problem? Do I have an alternative liability issue? Do I have a res ipsa loquitur issue where maybe this is the kind of thing that doesn't happen except where people are negligent? I don't know the answer to that, but I can at least pose it. So, again, you want to kind of use the let me just also back up and say that part of what I'm testing is your ability to be honest with yourself about what you know and what you don't know, that you learn to be honest about saying, hey, I don't know this. I don't know anything about this. But that isn't necessarily a disadvantage. It actually may be an advantage because you can now ask good questions. If this is the case, then this would follow. On the other hand, if it turns out to be this other thing, then something else would follow. You're asking the kinds of questions of the person who, you know, as the expression goes, it's not what you don't know that hurts you, it's what you know that ain't so. You start making assumptions that are quite reasonable based upon your experience doing construction or working as an anesthesiology nurse or what have you, and you're starting to say, oh, this isn't true and that isn't true. Excuse me, but stick to your knitting here. For these purposes, you are a lawyer, and the lawyer says, okay, this fact and this fact seem to be relevant to this issue over here. So, again, I would say that your ability to kind of move in and out of the things you know and you don't know will allow you to identify the legal issues. And, yes, it may take you a while, as we'll get into in more detail next semester with respect to statutes. Part of your job next semester will be to read these statutes, and they're no, you know, lucid, self-explanatory things. They're full of all kinds of weird stuff, and you have to navigate your way through that, just as you navigate your way through a fact pattern talking about this valve, you know, sprang loose, and then this bolt, you know, dropped into that thing, and then the guy got blown, you know, in the next county, and, you know, whatever it is, okay, what can I analyze from this in terms of the legal issues it would present? So, I think, again, as you sort of practice these things, practice your skill of threading your way through an area you don't know much about, but I'll take it for whatever it is, that this is related, because they tell me, this happened, then that happened, somebody claims it's a result of that, okay, if that were true, it would lead to this conclusion. On the other hand, if it weren't true, something else would follow. Does that answer your question? No. Mr. Kendall.
Just a clarification on the two prongs of the legal cause. The superseding cause and the victim was foreseeable.
Yes. That's two of the three.
Yeah.
Yes.
In particular, if I'm understanding correctly, the last part of the superseding cause you spoke about asking two questions.
Yes.
How foreseeable and also how disproportionate.
Yeah.
The culpability. I guess I'm asking where the line is drawn between the foreseeability there and what the actual third prong is for the victim was foreseeable. Is that speaking in terms of Cardozo versus Andrews?
Let me see if I can get us a little focused here. With respect to the superseding cause analysis kicks in where you have some 600-pound gorilla, basically. You've got someone who dominates the action. It's a car thief or a, you know, a murderer or something. In that case, you're going to have just one intervening cause. The plaintiff would characterize it as an intervening cause. The defendant would characterize it as a superseding cause. The difference between them being, did it break the chain of causation? And I would say that to get a handle on that, use the rule of thumb. How foreseeable was it? The more foreseeable it is to the defendant, the more likely the court is to say, it's not a superseding cause. That's the very thing you should have expected. If you don't light your parking lot well, if you casually hand out keys to, you know, motel rooms to people who wander up to the front desk and say, hey, I forgot my key, it's 728, and you just hand it to them without looking for any kind of, you know, security or what have you, well, what do you think's going to happen? People are going to break into other people's motel rooms. When they get surprised, they may assault them or, you know, do other bad things. This is not unforeseeable. Versus something else where you say, oh, it really was. I'm selling rat poison. You know, I'm not sitting there thinking, gee, I wonder who's not getting along with their wife. Who's gonna, that's, this is not foreseeable to me as a seller of rat poison. So that's, again, the contrast between what is and is not foreseeable, and again, relative culpability. Now again, superseding cause is distinguished from the Paul's graph issues because Paul's graph is not one big 600-pound gorilla. It's a bunch of little events that accumulate to generate this unexpected consequence. But sort of one of the advantages for the plaintiff is that there isn't a sharp dividing line. It sort of fades to black. You know, it's a shade of gray, and eventually you lose it. But it's harder to say, well, here's this sharp place in which it suddenly all the air comes out. Does that help?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You gave us the definitions of
intervening. Yeah. Those are what I would call dispositive labels. If I get to put that label on something, I've decided the issue. If it's merely an intervening cause, and again, my example is the dean walks in and intervenes. He participates in my class. He starts fielding questions. He starts interjecting comments, making observations. He's intervened. But he hasn't displaced me. As distinguished from, he supersedes me, suggests that I might take a seat so that he can then, you know, direct. Okay, an intervening cause is one that participates in. You can say, if I run a motel and part of what my guests expect out of the motel is security, if I start handing out keys to people who walk up to the front desk and ask for one, I could say, sure, the person who actually broke into that person's room is an intervening cause, but what do you expect? What I paid for was security. I'm paying $120 a night for this motel room, and these people don't even use any kind of care to prevent strangers from getting into my room. On the other hand, if I call it a superseding cause, I say, in effect, that the defendant played a role. The defendant was a chapter in this story, but when the superseding cause came along, it essentially started a whole new chapter. It broke the chain of causation such that it's no longer accurate to say that the defendant's negligence caused, much less proximately caused, the plaintiff's injury. Did the sale of rat poison proximately cause that murder? No, said the court. The act of the murderer was a superseding cause of the injury. Now again, what I want you to do on the exam is recognize that those labels are dispositive and that it's a judgment call to figure out which is which. You read the facts of the rat poison case, you don't know as you read them whether that act of the murderer will be characterized as an intervening cause or a superseding cause. You will ask yourself the question, gee, I wonder if this statute had in mind criminal use of fungicides, insecticides, and rodenticides. Or if it merely had in mind the negligent use of it, such that it didn't foresee, didn't anticipate this kind of use. In which case I would say the felonious use, the murderous use of the homicidal use of this rat poison is not just an intervening cause that came along and participated, it's a superseding cause that broke the chain of causation. Again, if that's the proper characterization, which the court said it was, defendant's off the hook. Whereas by contrast, if you say it's merely an intervening cause, you can keep the causal chain from the defendant's negligence through the act of these other parties to get to the plaintiff. Causal chain is intact, defendant's liability stands. And it's that differentiation that you want to make as you look at the fact pattern and say, if I were the defendant, I'd make a superseding cause argument versus, this is clearly, foreseeable cause, not going to go anywhere. Ms. Peterson.
Well, then, is it or is it not appropriate to use the term foreseeable and superseding in the same issue? I mean, it's two separate things. Like, because a superseding cause to me wouldn't be foreseeable, but yet I know foreseeable includes from a different section, and I don't want to...
Right. I would say foreseeability, rather than being an on-off switch, is a variable thing. Well, no, a superseding cause is one which, by definition, is not very foreseeable. That to characterize it, to get that label applied, to say this is a superseding cause, you need to show that it's relatively unforeseeable. Because the more foreseeable it is, the less successful you are at convincing a judge or a jury that it was superseding. So, for example, again, if, just to go use my example with Dean Morrissey, suppose they said tomorrow, because we're going to be talking about an issue that, Dan Morrissey handled for one of his clients, he's going to come in and talk to you about, this particular issue. Well, he walks in and talks about it, that's a much more, I sort of incorporated him into my little storyline. It's still my class. But I sort of control him. Whereas if he walks in and sort of, invites me to sit down and takes over, then you would say it's, I'm no longer the actor here. So, sorry. So in any event, that the labels intervening, superseding are ones that will ultimately determine is the defendant on the hook or is the defendant not on the hook. And foreseeability, I would say, is more of a sort of relative thing. Ice dams and flooding in the Buffalo River are not completely unforeseeable, but in this particular scenario, not very foreseeable. It's relative. Yeah.
Seems like,
well, the difference between Cardozo and Andrews is not that they aren't interested in similar issues, it's the emphasis on which area. Again, for Cardozo, foreseeability is the linchpin. It's the gate through which you must pass. Whereas Andrews is much more put it on the table along with other stuff and let the jury sort it out.
Okay.
But yeah, it's not like they speak a completely different language.
The record knows when Andrews. How did I didn't quite understand how Andrews put the limitation of damages through the proximate cause of the chain. You know, if someone gets in a car accident, the baby ends up falling down at the hospital, being dropped because of the sound. I'm not quite sure how he formulated that.
The way Andrews, he sort of had a metaphorical. You drop the pebble in the, you know, there are these concentric circles, as it were, of causation. And the near ones, you say, okay, this is how far we can say this proximately caused that. You get three blocks away where the, you know, the baby gets dropped, and you say, too far. Or you have the people operating the bridge or tying up the boat in the Buffalo River. Boats in the water, sure. Docks, you know, along the river shore, absolutely. Flooding victims, I don't know. People who can't get across the bridge to do business, no. You know. So again, you draw a line, unwavering and uncertain though it may be, says Andrews, but I'm going to draw a line as this far I can say there's proximate cause. Out here, too far.
Is that something he would do, or he would allow the jury
to do? He'd allow the jury to do, yeah. And again, he's saying this is a classic, practical, common sense judgment. It's not theory, it's not metaphysics, it's not principle, it's pragmatism. Going once, going twice. Mr. Cleveland.
How far in the chapter 3 do you anticipate will be by Friday?
Well, we've got two more days. What can we do in 2 days? Oh. There's a lot of reading in punitive damages. I don't need to tell you. Attorney's fees goes quickly. It's a hard call. I'd be prepared for wrongful death. It may be we fall short of it. If we fall short of it, so be it. We'll just pick it up next semester. But if we make it through wrongful death, it's a nice little sort of milestone. And the other nice thing is, again, the past exams often include wrongful death. But the more I think about it, the more it seems like a bridge too far. The thing we really haven't dealt with yet is this whole business of reading statutes. And as I'm sure you've discovered, these statutes are maddening because they're not written, they're not user-friendly. And a lot hangs on your ability to make sense of the statute. It's sort of a little art in itself. So if the first time we're really doing that is on Friday and then the exam is on Monday, that doesn't seem quite fair. So I guess as I stand here, I'm sort of questioning whether I could do that to you. But but we'll see. See you tomorrow.